Well, that riotous applause can only mean one thing. It's time for the KOW's Week in Review, typically with Bill Radke. He is out this week. I am in. My name is Luke Burbank. Lots to talk about from the week's news, and we do have a live audience here in the KUOW performance space. Let's say hi to the folks who are going to interpret the news for us this week. From the Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail, also formerly of the Seattle Times, Joni Balter is here.
Hey there. Good to be here.
Thank you. We also have the managing, is it managing editor or managing director of the Northwest News Network?
Managing editor.
The managing editor of the Northwest News Network, a good friend of mine, Phyllis Fletcher, is here as well.
Thank you.
And an old radio pal of mine.
An old radio pal of yours?
Previous.
The co-host of Seattle's Morning News, a Gilbert and Sullivan enthusiast, and the pride of, where was it in New York you're from?
Westchester County.
The pride of Westchester County, New York. Dave Ross is
Thank
here
you.
As well. All right, like I said, busy week of news. Let's get to it.
This is game changer. This is the heart of the allegations, and they're false. The complaint is meritless and now proven to be as such.
That is an attorney for Seattle Mayor Ed Murray talking about one of the developments this week, which is that Ed Murray's personal doctor and his lawyers say that anatomically he does not match the description given by somebody who claims that he sexually abused and raped them over 30 years ago. The mayor today had an op-ed piece that was in The Stranger in which he again vigorously denies the charges and also sort of puts it on the media for covering this story. It's a tough story to cover from that standpoint because these allegations are so toxic. And by the way, just in case you've been under a rock the last 2 weeks, three different men have claimed that the mayor sexually abused them many years ago when they were underage. One of them is bringing a lawsuit, a man from Kent who's 46 now. Joni Balter, the Seattle Times gets a lot of criticism from the mayor today in that op-ed piece for reporting this at all. When you have an allegation that even the mention of it could destroy a political career, is there a different level of responsibility for the media?
Well, yes, of course there is. I would like to say that I fully respect the Seattle Times, used to work there. I think they had a hard decision to make. There are some aspects of this that we can break down as we go here as to, you know, timing, how much time did they give the mayor to respond. I was hosting Civic Cocktail the last Wednesday night, and so the mayor was with 240 folks at the Tom Douglas Palace Ballroom till 6:30 with New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. So one of the questions, a fair question, is did the Seattle Times give him enough time to respond? The story ran the next day in the afternoon. I don't have the exact hour of that. So that's one question. Another question we should break down here. The timing of the editorial telling the mayor that he should not run for re-election.
Which was in the Seattle Times.
Which
as well.
Was in the Seattle Times, whether or not it's all true or not true.
How have you guys been covering this over on Cairo Radio, Dave?
I have not done anything extensive on it. When I read the editorial the mayor's op-ed in The Stranger today, it made sense to me that if you're going to go public with something like this, you'd want to get his point of view first, just to make sure that you are not falling for somebody's made-up story. You could ask things like, well, why would they come forward? What was your job at this youth center? Just to make doubly sure. Personally, if I were the reporter, I'd feel a little insecure about going after someone's reputation unless I had talked to them first. I've been in that situation a couple of times and actually elected to hold on to the story because it didn't make sense once I talked to the person who was being accused, especially when you're talking about somebody who initially, anyway, was going to remain anonymous.
I mean, the Seattle Times says that they considered reporting this story or a version of this story. I think it was in 2008, maybe. And they did their research and they just felt like there wasn't quite enough there. So, I mean, they had been sitting on this for a long time. Right. Phyllis Fletcher, what do you make of this?
Yeah, they had been sitting on the allegations from Oregon. And I understand, you know, based on the information that we have right now, I understand why they didn't then, what the difference is between a suit having been filed and having not been filed. And I completely understand the mayor feeling like he didn't have enough time. That's a really short timeline this time around. And I would guess that part of the publication timeline was driven by the lawsuit filing mm-hmm. time. Someone was going to be reporting it that day. I totally get that.
I just feel like it is newsworthy when the mayor of a city has a lawsuit filed against them over something that's this potentially damaging. So, I mean, anybody who's arguing it's not worth reporting, I guess the stronger argument would be if you were trying to argue for the Seattle Times and other media not covering it is it's so damaging you can't get into it. But I don't think there's any argument that it's not newsworthy, right?
No, I don't think that's the argument. But they worked on it for a long time. They did some extensive investigation, including talking to people who, I believe, occupied the apartment where these things took place. So they, back then, could have asked the mayor about this. It's not like you're trying to go after the president or something. There's no national security considerations involved here. And if you're worried about the competition picking up the lawsuit, sure, go with it when the lawsuit's filed, but they're working on it well before that, I believe, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, they were working on it. It did come to folks' attention back in 2008, and the thought then was that it just didn't rise to provable enough, so why would you do that? I will say that we all, at least this is how I feel, need to put a brown bag over our collective heads here. With some of the details that were published, I'm not sure those needed to be in the initial story for a couple of reasons. First of all, it kind of demeans everybody to know all of that kind of stuff. And then additionally, it sort of limits future folks who might come forward to tell a story. And now everybody has these details. So that was one thing I thought maybe should not have been in there. Timing, maybe like Phyllis says, a little bit more time for the mayor to sort of figure out what he's actually going to say. It's totally a legitimate news story, for sure. Once it's filed as a lawsuit, yes, indeed. But there's another thing that we should all consider is that sort of once you get on board with a story like this, this is just a natural journalistic tendency, is you sort of don't back down. You don't see the Washington Post or the New York Times saying, yeah, that Trump, he had nothing to do with Russia. You just don't do that after you've started down that road. And so that is a sort of natural inclination for a newspaper to take.
Speaking of the Seattle Times, I think it was the Seattle Times that had what I thought was maybe the most understated headline of the week when they said something to the effect of controversy surrounding Ed Murray may open some doors for other candidates for mayor. I mean, understatement of the year, right? Because right or wrong, whether or not this should be reported, we are now at a point where his political career is very much in peril. And what I find interesting is that other folks involved in the Seattle City Council have been largely mum. I mean, unusually restrained. Other people who might have designs on the mayor's office have also mostly been quiet. I want to play a clip from Bruce Harrell, who is a city council, the president of the city council, talking about this. It's Murray Cut One, Bernard.
All accusations of abuse require a thorough investigation. It is our human nature to immediately want answers, but I ask we not cast aspersions to the parties involved before we have all the facts through a legal process.
So that is about the hottest piece of tape we have related to this
that
issue.
That is some good. Smoking hot tape, I will tell you.
Even Shama Sawant, who is not afraid of making bold statements, said something extremely measured, saying that any rape allegation needs to be investigated thoroughly. It's an important thing. But stopping well short of saying anything about what may or may not have happened with the current mayor. Is it surprising that nobody is sort of getting further out in front of this as far as his potential opponents?
No, because if every person you talk to says, I don't know, we don't know, I don't know, I don't know if anybody here thinks they know, I don't even think the Seattle Times knows for sure. There are a few people who do know. Mayor Ed Murray knows, some of these victims know. Those are the folks who know. This is so hard to parse.
Alleged victims.
Alleged victims. Fair.
Part of the whole issue here, I think.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And yeah. and you don't want to be the person who comes out first being like, I'm going to be mayor now. Like, that's tacky, right? right. You can't do that. Even
I was
if
considering
that,
doing that this week, and I thought better of it.
Well, there was a tacky in there where where this political consultant said, right as this is breaking, well, I've been talking to this female candidate for mayor, and we might just convince her to run, like right in the middle of this, which just really nobody liked that.
Yeah.
You have to imagine, though, that behind closed doors, there are people who definitely see this as a huge opportunity, right?
Yeah. I mean, oh, of course.
This was sort of Murray's popularity had him essentially trotting towards the end zone for reelection, and it was only something really catastrophic like this could make a difference.
Yeah. I guess the question is, what should he do now? And this comes up in a lot of these cases. If you truly are innocent, and that was the premise of his piece in Crosscut, how do you salvage your reputation against something like this? And if it turns out to have been and he says it's fabricated, so if this was just made out of whole cloth, there ought to be a penalty for the people who made this up, right?
Well, sure. I mean, you can tell that the mayor's legal strategy is to try to silence this as quickly as possible by putting forward this, again, information from his doctor and by questioning mm-hmm. the sort of criminal background of at least one of the people who brought these allegations. I mean, they're trying to contain this as much as possible. It's a really hard story to contain. I guess my question is there any universe in which Ed Murray actually wins re-election as mayor of Seattle?
If he countersues... Why doesn't he countersue for libel, claiming malice, since I think one of the accusers said, yes, we did time this to come right before the election. The lawyer apparently has a history of opposing LGBT issues, right?
No, his partner.
The lawyer's partner,
yeah,
right,
that's
the
fair.
One who's
that's
public.
In any
right,
case,
yeah.
This is what he brought out in the Crosscut piece today.
Mm-hmm.
He probably wouldn't win the lawsuit. But it would certainly be an indication that he's serious about saying this was plucked out of thin air and just made public. They snookered the Seattle Times somehow into publishing this for the express purpose of destroying my career.
Well, looking ahead, this is my take on this. Again, we all don't know, but Ed Murray does know. So if this happened and if he's guilty of this, He should not run for re-election. The Seattle Times editorial would be right on that. But if he's innocent, he should run like hell for re-election. Because I don't want to live in a James Comey world where right before an election, somebody steps...
Newsflash, Joni, you do.
Oh, dear.
Darn, really?
I don't know if you've been reading the papers lately.
Yeah. So, but I don't want to live in that world where something can come up just a few weeks before election and change everything. And it's one or two or three people's decision to do that.
But do you think, Phyllis, do you think that there's, from a PR standpoint, do you think that there's any way that he can... I don't know, Dave thinks a countersuit mm-hmm. might do it. But, like, do you think there's any way that he can rehab his reputation? Again, fair or unfair that it's been besmirched in time to actually get reelected as mayor?
Well, yeah, I guess that's why they have crisis communications folks on this, right? They're a lot smarter about this stuff than I am, for sure, and they get paid way more, and rightfully so.
You do work
very
in public
hard.
Radio.
Exactly.
So.
But they're
I
all working for United Airlines right now, aren't they?
Yeah.
They've all been pulled in.
Watch this space. That's our next topic.
Right. But I think that, I mean, what I, as we'll learn later, I'm quite weak on sports, but I'm very strong on sports metaphors. And I kept thinking this is a marathon, not a sprint. And what I see on both sides is this kind of sprint mentality. And maybe there's some magic to that that I don't understand because I'm not in crisis communications. But when I saw, okay, now here's the press conference about the private areas. And, you know, this proves once and for all that this didn't happen. It actually doesn't do that. It makes everyone very uncomfortable. It gives us more information about what a doctor's opinion is of his private area, but it doesn't disprove the entire thing. And I feel like what's going to make this feel like a long, 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 long marathon is every new thing that comes out being declared the thing that proves that person's side. That's going to make it a long road to November.
And both sides are really playing it in the press. Originally, we were told this would not be, that the mayor's side would not be played in the press, but he, you know, the press conference, the op-ed today that he wrote in The Stranger, I mean, you know, Both sides always play that. It's a bit of a tennis ball going back and forth across.
They all say, we're not going to litigate this in the court of public opinion, and that's exactly what they do, because well, right now that's the only court.
Yeah, that's the court considering it, for real.
But that's why they're going so quickly, because everybody wants to establish first impressions here, and because that's very important, as I understand it, in crisis communications.
Right.
Yeah, it does already feel like this has been going on for months or
maybe years.
I spent more time this week meditating on the difference between a bump and a mole than I usually do, particularly related to politicians.
We don't want to know any more.
That's fine.
Okay.
This is as good a time as any to change the topic. This is KUOW's Week in Review. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm sitting in for Bill Radke this week. We are in the KUOW performance space with about 40 or so of the most attractive public radio listeners you could ever imagine. We also have a great panel. We have Joni Balter from the Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. We have Dave Ross from Seattle's Morning News on Cairo Radio. And we have Phyllis Fletcher from the Northwest News Network. United Airlines made some serious news this week. Their stock ended down a little bit over a half a billion dollars as of yesterday. Markets are off today because of the holiday. Of course, this was in the aftermath of the video that we have all seen of them having police officers drag a passenger off of one of their flights going from Chicago to Louisville. The passenger had paid for their ticket. They were in their seat. They were not being belligerent, at least not before police approached. And this has been really, really damaging to United. I would just say, what are the chances for United that this would be the one flight where people had cell phones? It's just dumb luck for them. That I mean, it's a sort of a surreal video to watch, because this person is being, as they like to say at United Airlines, what was it?
Reaccommodated.
No.
There's a word that will not catch on.
No. Forcibly deplaned, I think.
Jimmy Kimmel said that they reaccommodated him the way that the U.S. reaccommodated El Chapo from Mexico to the U.S. That's Jimmy Kimmel's joke, but it's a good one. This has been extremely bad PR for United Airlines. And also, it was announced this week that this man who was removed, Dr. David Dow, is now suing. His attorney says that he has a broken nose. He lost two teeth in this. He was concussed. This is his attorney, Thomas Demetrio. Bernard, this is United 6. Let's play that.
Here's what he told me. He said that he left Vietnam in 1975 when Saigon fell. And he was on a boat. And he said he was terrified. He said that being dragged down the aisle was more horrifying and harrowing than what he experienced in leaving Vietnam.
Pretty dramatic statement from the guy hired to help try to
bring
win
the drama.
He should be working on the whole mayoral issue here in Seattle. He'd do great. So this guy obviously is the attorney for the guy dragged off the plane. He's there to try to build the drama and make sure that his client gets the best shot as far as some sort of settlement goes. For me, the news flash from this story was that the airlines, when you buy a ticket, it does not entitle you to actually fly on the airplane that you bought a ticket for. Did you know this on the panel? I did not. Joni, did you know?
No, absolutely didn't know that. But there's a lot of things we don't know about the airplanes that we go on sometimes. And, you know, it feels to me that...
That's ominous.
No. And true.
The cleaning. I mean, you know, nothing too scary. But you know, this is happening at a time when folks already feel that the airlines are sort of treating them not very well. Mm-hmm. You know, the flight, everyone can tell you a story about a flight that they were on. You're on a flight, someone was, you know, leaning into your seat. This just happened to me. I mean, I was shriveled into the edge of my seat for about a four-hour flight back. Mm. I mean, they have cut the space so much. They are making so much money. They have so consolidated. And it doesn't feel like they really are thinking about the consumer. So this goes on top of that as a big consumer issue. You folks have been paying attention to your profits and less to the customers. And that's why it just took off. I mean, it just took off.
Well, airports are police states. And we've gotten used to that. You do whatever they say, and it changes for me every
I've
single time
with
at the
you,
gate.
Dave. You and you are particularly permissive. You keep your head down.
Exactly. My whole purpose is to be as let them humiliate me any way they want, because the last thing I want is to be dragged off the plane and lose two teeth.
Oh.
So. If they tell you to take off your belt one day and not the next, or take off one shoe, your left shoe and not your right shoe, or we're going to swab you here, or we're going to pat down your genitals, we submit to it. And I think that has started to infuse airport culture in some way, such that you will, I mean, right, no jokes, nothing.
But they have recently hired a few kind of TSA jokers, I've noticed.
Have they?
Just, I feel like those guys are freelancing. I mean that. There's always there's always a sort of one person at TSA who decides that they're a modern day George Carlin, and they're gonna you the sort of 411 as you come in.
But this is the thing: you will behave absolutely, and if we tell you to do something, you will. I actually was familiar with the fact that you are not expressly guaranteed. It's a contract of carriage. You're not guaranteed. They can bump you for a certain number of reasons. They have to compensate you, of course, but you have to be prepared for that. My idea was that since they're selling us, 6 inches of leg room and this and that, why not sell us seat insurance, a seat guarantee? For an extra $5, we'll take you off the bump list, right? And as the seats are being sold, when you get down to the last four people to book on that flight, they don't get the insurance option, right? So then they become the ones who are bumpable, and they know that going in, plus the airlines make some extra money.
Don't you think it's far more likely that they will get rid of the overbooking? Because, seriously...
Because that's a big part of their whole financial model.
No, but United Airlines could have rented a private jet to take those four there to compare to...
I thought it was
a billion. I thought it was a billion, but it doesn't matter. Close enough.
It was at one point.
Right,
they bounced back a little bit, like a plane coming in on a hard landing. they recaptured about a $500 million of that.
Phyllis? Well, I had an idea, too. So I was inspired by local playwright Chad Galler Sojourner, who pointed out that, they always give these, we'd like to offer you $200, and then you wait, $400, $800. He's like, no, start at the top, honey. And I'm thinking, not only is that a great idea, but you could, since they're so sophisticated with their financial models, why not eBay it while you're buying your ticket? How much would it take to get you to be bumped? And then they could find out from that who has the lowest price. You agree to be bumped in advance. Hey, because I would agree to $1,500. The only viral video would be moonwalking off the plane. I'd be like, pace.
That's true. They only went to $800. They could have gone to $2,000.
Okay.
I think that's why this is so maddening for people. I mean, not only because this is physical violence that didn't need to happen, but also if they would have just upped the amount of money being offered.
Exactly.
Well, they're limited though. I think it was like $1,350
But that's another question I have.
Who wrote that?
Why should there be a ceiling on how much money? And by the way, it's not even real money. It's airline bucks. That's the other thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You offer people 1,000 real U.S. dollars.
See ya.
Watch how fast people are off the plane.
Yep.
So this is a solvable problem. To me, it's like the business model for the airlines is they oversell these flights, which helps them make sure that it's less likely that an airplane is going somewhere with empty seats. Okay, so that's I guess they're right. But the penalty for when that goes wrong is they should just have to give everyone $5,000 who got bumped. People would be so excited to be bumped at that point. This doctor would probably have been excited to be bumped.
He was somehow not going to have to be at the hospital the next day if it was $5,000.
Right.
There is a bump culture out there, people who trade information on how to get bumped. Because you can make a lot of money. So I think that's why they put a limitation on it.
Is this you at the airport, though? This is your... Yeah.
I'm thinking once I retire, I'll be a professional bumpy and just fly everywhere for free.
That is Dave Ross from Seattle's Morning News on Cairo Radio. We've also got Phyllis Fletcher here from Northwest News Network and Joni Balter from the Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm sitting in for Bill Radke this week on KUOW's Week in Review. We're talking about the issues that United Airlines had this week. And I'll tell you what, if there was some sort of magic formula that the CEO of United Airlines could have said to make this all go away, he did not say those magic words, at least at first. This is Oscar Munoz on Good Morning America once he had finally gotten the memo about being apologetic. Bernardo, this is United 3.
In the future, if no one voluntarily decides to leave a plane, based on the amount of money that United is offering.
We are not going to put a law enforcement official to take them off the
airplane. A law enforcement official will never come on one of your planes again.
To remove a booked, paid seating passenger, we can't do that.
No S, Sherlock.
No, right.
Well, instead, they'll just seat a crying baby right next to
right. That's actually an interesting deterrent, yeah. is when they want to get you off the plane, just make it so inhospitable right. that you will voluntarily try to deplane. So the change in policy, I don't know if this is formalized yet, but he says they're not going to have law enforcement pull people off of United Airlines flights. Also, everyone who was on that flight was apparently compensated for the full price of their ticket. For what that was worth. But this was like the worst handling of this from a PR standpoint that you possibly could have had, because he initially said that the passenger had been belligerent.
Yeah.
Then wrote a memo internally mm-hmm. to United mm-hmm. Airlines mm-hmm. telling everybody basically, heck of a job, Brownie. Mm-hmm.
But that goes to what we were saying earlier, first impressions. It took mm-hmm. him too many days to get to the fact that yeah. we are not going to reaccommodate in that matter. And it's not exactly United Airlines week. You heard about the scorpion on one of the other
oh,
planes
dear.
Right.
as well. Scorpion, overhead bin, not good. Sorry, United.
I'm sick of these scorpions on this plane.
They should reaccommodate the scorpion.
I had another idea of how to get people off the plane faster, by the way. Guilt-tripping grandmas. You hire them to just stand there in the aisle. I don't know why you're not leaving this plane. I just don't understand. I think it would work. It would be cheaper than law enforcement, and there would be zero physical contact.
I was doing a deep dive this week on like what the actual rules are for getting pulled off the plane if no one will take a bump. And it actually varies from airline to airline. Some of them, and there is apparently officially a rule that if you're forcibly removed from the plane, they have to provide to you in writing what the criteria was that they used to take non-volunteers off the plane. Some planes, it's who paid the least for their ticket. Mm-hmm. Some airlines, it's whoever checked in last, which puts me in extreme jeopardy.
Yes.
But they have different systems for, apparently there are some airlines that have like the worst lotto of all time. It's a computer that randomly draws some seat numbers and you could get pulled off for that. Somebody told me this week, I have not confirmed this, but if you are in a mileage club, you are not on the list of people who will be potentially forcibly removed.
Well, it depends, because there was a guy who was kicked out of first class because he was something like a gold member. And a platinum member wanted his seat,
ooh.
And they were overbooked because the plane was smaller than had been scheduled, and they took him off.
Mm. Well, how about this crazy idea? If someone's physically on the plane, then these other people are lollygagging in the back and they haven't boarded yet, maybe start with them just to reduce sort of how it looks on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I've become a monster in that. I have all that little status with the airline now because I travel a lot for work, and so I am like, when they say, we'd like to welcome active members of the military, people with small children, and elite club members, I'm like right there, which is a person I never thought I would become. But I think it's because when you travel, it's such a grind. It's so soul crushing. If you earn some small amount of status that gets you one little perk, you're a fool not to take it.
Right.
This is The Week in Review on KUOW. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm sitting in for Bill Radke, who is traveling, I'm sure, at the very back of the line, being extremely cool and chill about it, unlike me.
Head down, Bill. Head down.
That's right. We have Dave Ross here from Cairo Radio and Joni Balter from the Seattle Channel and Phyllis Fletcher from the Northwest News Network. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. That is a completely spontaneous applause from the crowd here at the KUOW Performance Center. My name is Luke Burbank. I'm sitting in for Bill Radke this week. We have Phyllis Fletcher from Northwest News Network, Joni Balter from the Seattle Channel, and my old pal Dave Ross from Cairo Radio in Seattle. We're talking through the week's news. This is a very odd story that we're going to talk about next with, unfortunately, some really serious implications. But what is a 13-letter word starting with C that is rarely written next to the New York Times crossword puzzle?
Oh, dear.
That would be controversial. It happened this week. Will Shortz, the puzzle master for the New York Times, decided to use a puzzle that had been submitted by a man in Washington State, man's named Lonnie Burton. It ran on Monday, and it was about James Bond stuff. That was sort of the theme. Now, what Will Shortz mentioned when they ran the puzzle was that Lonnie Burton is currently in jail in Washington State. What he did not mention was the crime that Lonnie Burton is doing 46 years for, which is robbery and also rape of a child. Extremely serious offense, and one that had the people in the comment section of the New York Times crossword puzzle, which is a more vibrant place than I realized, had the people there really of two minds on this. It seemed to be, based on my kind of just looking through it, mostly going negative. There seem to be a lot of people who feel like there are crimes that are so serious, we shun you from, I mean, not only do we incarcerate you, but we also shun you from what we would consider to be normal life, and submitting a crossword puzzle to the New York Times is on that list for some people. Are there, Dave, are there crimes that are so serious that our response as a society is to say we will not interact with you on any level?
Well, clearly in this case, yes. And I think maybe part of it has to do with the nature of the thing we're talking about. I'm not very good at crossword puzzles, but when I commit to one, I'm all in. And I feel I don't want to use the word intimate with it because of the context, but what I'm saying is you get really involved in these puzzles. And if you're giving yourself over, and basically you're giving yourself over to the whoever conjured it up and committing to their conceit and sort of buying into your... You're interacting really personally with them.
You're sort of inside their brain, I guess to some degree.
And so, I don't know, maybe it's because if I was, for example, if the guy had written a book about his crimes as a way to explain to me why people do this, I'd have no trouble reading that. But sort of doing this recreational activity, it's like going to the playground with the guy in a way, right? Hmm. And I think maybe that would explain the visceral reaction that this got.
Hmm. Phyllis?
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that because I don't do those types of puzzles very much, and that really draws me into the world of a puzzle doer and why you'd feel so hurt about doing a puzzle when you feel like something had been obfuscated about what the deal was. And I was thinking about it from more of a journalistic standpoint and thinking about how everyone has an editor, but maybe that's not true in Will Shortz's case, because my thinking as an editor was he had this little editorial note next to the puzzle saying this came from a prisoner and I believe in redemption and here's a puzzle from someone who's in prison. And that's kind of where he stopped his process, because my very next question is, what did he do? And I think that any good editor or just any inquisitive human would ask that. And what I feel like he didn't anticipate was people asking that. And he even says in his defense to the ombuds officer for New York Times, well, people can look that up themselves. And it's like, well, yeah, people will look that up themselves, and they did. And then they have feelings, and those feelings are directed towards the prisoner, Will, and the New York Times. So,
well, right, because what Will Shortz said to the person at the Times who wrote about this was, I didn't put the specific crime in there because it would really color people's opinion of the puzzle. And I thought, well, that might be an indicator of something.
That's a yellow flag. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I believe, as many Washingtonians do, in transparency, you know, of the laws, the PDC here, Washington is a big believer. Tell us as much as you can. And so also as a journalist, I would always err on the side of tell us as much as you can. So put that in there and then let the crossword rip, let it go. And the reason so many people were commenting was because they couldn't think of the answers. That's obvious. They were just like, okay, I can't think of that answer. I'll go to the comment section.
Huh. So you think that frustrated them because they were in another headspace because of this guy's backstory. See, I'm sort of the worst person to be, helping out with this conversation, because I am extremely bad at crossword puzzles. I mean, I will find a half filled out Us Magazine crossword puzzle on the airplane.
Us Magazine.
And I'll be
that is
like,
tough. That one's,
you know, four letter word, and it's like Brad Pitt's last name, and I can't figure it out. So I'm to pivot off of the very serious part of this story onto maybe the less serious part. Do you up here on the panel do crosswords? Are you able to do this?
I can only do up to Tuesday, but I'll front and bring it in on Saturday to a restaurant.
You'll go sit in a coffee shop and fill it out like it, hoping nobody checks the fine print. Yeah. What about you, Joni?
No, not big on the crosswords. Mm. So.
I do the ones my wife can't finish.
Hmm.
Just to try and feel like I'm on a par with her. But yeah, I mean,
that isn't on a par. That's I got the ones you didn't get.
Well, no, we have different areas of expertise, Joni. Not
complimentary.
One area is not superior.
Don't become
to the
a marriage
other.
Counselor, Joni. I don't. Think
oh dear.
I don't feel like it's really
Step
your
right
strength.
Up.
I haven't been married
Step
this
right
long
up.
By accident.
What were you going to say, Dave?
This raises a more serious question, though, which is you talked about redemption, and that's an important thing because we have still, I believe, the largest prison population in the world because all our sentences are life sentences, essentially. So I think it's legitimate to ask.
You mean for sex offenders, right?
Almost for anything, though, right? Because mm-hmm. once you're in prison, we set you free, but you get the worst jobs if you get one at all. I mean, you look at the number of people who are homeless. A lot of it is because there's a felony on the record, and you can't find anything. I think we have to have a conversation about when it's okay to forgive from these crimes, when you've actually, you know, paid the price. Now, whether that extends to feeling comfortable doing a crossword puzzle, it maybe is another thing. But we are creating this pariah class, which is pretty much artificially created. There are still people who do bad things, but may have skills, may be able to reform, and we never let them.
I think that the reason that we tend to find something like a sex crime so abhorrent is because there's this thought that somebody could commit a murder or a robbery. You wouldn't have the sense that there's a voice inside their head constantly pushing them towards that behavior years and years later. As far as sexual attraction and sexual compulsion, there is this sense. I mean, this is why we have these sort of sex offenders who are committed basically for the rest of their life,
right?
Because we think this is the way that your brain and arousal system works, and we can't trust you out in the wider world. So it's interesting to me that had this guy, Lonnie Burton, had he been convicted of murder, I bet you that this would be less offensive to people. I mean, that's just my hot take, but that's my sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're probably right. But there has to be some solution to this. Maybe a commission that can sort of give you a certificate of redemption at some point. But I think there's something wrong. We still have like 2.5 million people, right? And that doesn't count those who have been in prison and then released and now have to deal with trying to live the rest of their lives somehow.
It should be just mentioned, I guess, as we wrap this topic up, that the Los Angeles Times also printed a puzzle that was submitted by this guy, Lonnie Burton. Mm-hmm. And I guess they just decided to not get into it, or maybe they didn't realize. I mean, it could have just showed up and said inmate, and they didn't do the research. So in an odd way, this is sort of Will Shortz being hoisted by his own petard, right? Because nobody said anything when the LA Times ran a thing by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Luke Burbank, sitting in for Bill Radke this week. We have a panel of news experts here who I'm sure, as they were coming over to the KUOW performance space where we are currently broadcasting from, nobody at any time looked at their phone or device in the car when they should not have been, because we all know that is dangerous.
It's true.
And it should not happen.
I forgot my smartphone today.
The house, the state house in Washington, is trying to get even tougher about using your devices, digital devices, while you're on the road. Because the current law, by the way, the House approved something this week that had already been approved by the Senate. It's essentially waiting for the governor to sign it now. The current rules are you're not allowed to be talking on your phone, having your phone up to your ear. You're not allowed to text while you drive. But the law doesn't actually say anything about Facebook or Tinder or my version of Tinder, Redfin. And so some state lawmakers realized, some would say wisely, that they need to address all the other things that we now do on our phone that aren't just talking or texting. The new piece of legislation, it will prohibit holding a personal electronic device, watching video on a device, or using a hand. This is where it gets really complicated. Using a hand or finger to use the device's features other than to activate or deactivate it. Pushing a button with one finger to initiate hands-free calling will be allowed.
How about that?
That's going to be tough to prove, but yeah.
That's what I'm wondering.
That's going
to
be so tough.
How are they going to prove you used more than one finger to do whatever was happening on your device?
It's going to be tough, but you know, look, this legislation, we're not tough here at all. We're very lenient. The fact is you can drive down the highway right now holding the phone here's the steering wheel, and the phone is beneath your chin. That, you know, that isn't a very safe way to drive. That isn't. And you can use all, you can be ordering products on Amazon if you want while you're driving and sitting at the stoplight. I mean, I think we ought to realize if the numbers were going a different way on pedestrian and auto deaths, and we should behave differently. But frankly, this is a problem. Distracted driving is not safe.
A little, some facts behind it. Apparently, there were 171 distracted driving deaths in Washington in 2015,
Yikes.
Just to put it in context. This is one of those things that I think everybody knows is a dangerous and bad idea. They say, I don't know how scientific this data is, but they say that looking at a text takes between 5 and 7 seconds. You can travel, it's like 2 football fields in that time in your car.
Dear.
So we know it's dangerous, but there is this little sense, I think, in a lot of our minds, not yours, Dave,
right?
But a lot of our minds, that you're just going to look really quick and then you'll keep your eyes on the road. One of the things, though, about this piece of legislation that I found somewhat chilling is that it also applies to when you're sitting at a stoplight or a stop sign. So if you are in your car, even if you're sitting still, you are not supposed to be checking your phone. I don't know what I'm going to do with that 30 seconds.
Feel
my feelings?
Happens.
No way.
But here's what happens in those 30 seconds. You see, if people in the dark, in the rain, are about to cross, you take in the intersection to see what does it really look like. So even though those are important 30 seconds to all of us who do that at a stoplight, we shouldn't be doing that. It really makes it less safe.
All that stuff you just talked about, way more boring than what's on my phone.
Well, yeah. I didn't say it was exciting.
Do you even have a smartphone yet, Dave?
Yeah, right. He probably doesn't. He has one of those flips.
No, like, I do. But I will tell you, I left it at home accidentally today because I was going to, use it as my cheat sheet instead of all the, these pages of papers that you have. And
thanks
a lot.
We're proud of those.
I will admit, I felt so naked that about halfway across the floating bridge, I just contemplated doing a U-ey into the express lanes and going back the other way.
Mm-hmm.
But there was that darn barrier, so.
Well, I will admit, I did it this morning at a stoplight, and I knew we were talking about this, and I wrote this whole thing last night. I need the nanny state to tell me to stop, because I clearly do this at stop signs, stoplights, all the time. I'm like, ooh, let me just rewind the
I know this, Phyllis, because you and I are friends, and we text a lot, and there's no universe in which you could be sending that many texts and not at some point be in your vehicle.
By the way, that was hilarious when you said blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Constantly.
Well, that's going to be a pretty easy case to solve.
I know,
court,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Case dismissed. Yeah.
We're at this interesting point, though, where you have these technologies that are emerging. So the phones are getting smarter and more complex, and they have more stuff on there that we want to see. And then you also have autonomous vehicles coming at some point, and even regular cars now getting smarter where they can brake for you. There's a light that will go off on the mirror, side mirror, if you're trying to merge and there's a car in the blind spot. I mean, this is, I think we're in a sort of unique, I don't know what it is, 20, 40, 50 years, where we still have to drive our cars, but we have this distracting magic tablet with us. Mm-hmm. Because at some point, the car will just pick us up and take us somewhere, you'd think.
Yeah, but I'd rather be driving in a driverless car where they're at least trying to drive safely instead of one where somebody's distracted and honking and looking at their phone. Just if I had the choice.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you planning on violating this law, the first violation will carry a total penalty of $136. Second and subsequent infractions have a total penalty of $235. A driver stopped for another traffic violation who was also using a cell phone could be cited for a second infraction of dangerously distracted driving. My solution for this in my own life is what it often is, which is trying to combat technology with buying more technology.
Mm-hmm.
I ordered this thing off a Kickstarter. It's called a Light Phone. I have not gotten it yet because it's a Kickstarter, so it's taken like 6 years. But what this thing promises to be is a little a credit card size cell phone. It doesn't have a screen on it. It just has the normal buttons, that we grew up with on the telephone. Mm-hmm. You can make calls on it and you can receive calls. And that is it. So the idea is that you sort of slowly wean yourself off of your phone addiction by taking this with you when you go places. You're still kind of connected to the wider world, but not in that same obsessive way.
So kind of an adult pacifier. Is what you're saying.
That's a less graceful way to describe it, Dave, but I guess you could call it that. This is The Week in Review on KUOW. That is Dave Ross from Cairo Radio in Seattle. We've also got Joni Balter here from the Seattle Channel, formerly of the Seattle Times, and Phyllis Fletcher from the Northwest News Network. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back with more. Welcome back to the Week in Review on KUOW. My name is Luke Burbank, sitting in for Bill Radke. This week, we are going through the week's news. That little bit of music you heard there, the Mariners theme that you're now hearing again. Thanks, Bernard. Well, it harkens back to a better time in this team's history before they were 2-8 as they start the current season. Back to the days of Ken Griffey Jr., a.k.a. the Kid. Yesterday, the Mariners unveiled an 11-foot-tall statue of Ken Griffey Jr. outside of the stadium. Here's some tape of Ken talking about that. This is Griffey 1, Bernard.
I played baseball for one reason. That was just to go out and play because I love the game of baseball. And to have an organization do all these things in the last 18 months has been truly unbelievable and overwhelming.
Ken Griffey Jr. was inducted into the Hall of Fame for baseball, and so the Mariners have been sort of celebrating him a lot lately. Also, it conveniently distracts everybody from what is currently happening
right.
with the team, which is not just losing at 2-8, but almost like scientifically engineering games to destroy your soul as a fan. You know, giving up seven runs in the bottom of the ninth on one game, leading by five. We don't have to go into it right now. My question to you, and we have Joni Balter here, Dave Ross, and also Phyllis Fletcher. Is it possible, Phyllis, that Safeco Field is built on a Native American burial ground?
Of course. The entire city is.
I mean, really, think about the layout of Seattle. The chances are better that it is.
Absolutely. Isn't. Yeah. You know, I feel sad for you when you think we're going to win. I feel sad for you when you think that we're supposed to get to the World Series. And I know...
I have a very dysfunctional relationship with this baseball team.
You do. It's so sad. So, you know, I say embrace it, you know, like just like pretend we're back in the Kingdom days. And it's Gaylor Perry and like hot dogs and those weird little chocolate malts you get in the yellow cup. And just enjoy it for what it is.
Which is a very, very painful way to spend six months of your life.
I know.
Yeah. Dave, I know you're not obsessed with the Mariners, but I mean, you would like it if they were good, right?
I would love it.
It would be
if
they could win a game.
There was nothing more exciting than the 1995 season. I think most of us will remember that. My kids were young and they were engaged in it. The 2001 season was also an amazing season. It was not to be, you know, because the Yankees just had to win that year. But at least we're not the 1988 Baltimore Orioles, is what I tell myself. Who began the season? This is my one baseball stat, by the way.
Okay, everybody, get ready.
All right.
1988 Baltimore Orioles went 0-21.
Oh.
Before they finally
won. So there's something
again.
To shoot for.
So good to know we can't do that, but we got to watch out for our expectations.
Exactly.
You're sitting there thinking you're going to win. That's your problem. You kind of just got to go with we're in the season.
Yeah. This
sounds is fun, and we have the longest drought in the playoffs of you know of any team.
Right.
We're just
this grooving. We can basically do the thing where you have a paper bag, you cut holes in the eyes. It can be a whole thing being a fan of this team. This just sounds like I'm just saying this to be dramatic for the radio, but this shows you how delusional I am. At the beginning of the season, I went in my iCloud calendar and I blocked out the weeks of when I thought the World Series would potentially be. Just so I had that on my radar.
That's so sad.
And have you fixed that? Have you fixed that yet or no?
That's the jinx.
I'm the one who did it.
That's the jinx, yeah.
That's like being on the cover of Sports Illustrated or something.
Do you remember the motto in 1984?
1984. Yeah, if you're one of the first nine people here, you get to play.
Their alternate motto was anything can happen. Yeah. So, you know, just keep it there. Just that naive hope. Anything can happen.
I think, I don't know if it was the best or worst Mariner like catchphrase they had, but when their coach was Jim LaFever, who had a very unique spelling of his last name.
Yes. Wasn't it Catch the Fever?
No, it was I'm a LaFever believer. Believer was spelled with like three V's that just showed up from somewhere. All right, continuing on the sports beat here, if you are a Seahawk fan and if you love the idea of the old school Seahawks, and by old school I mean 3-4 years ago when they had Marshawn and Richard Sherman, the next year's Seahawks team may look nothing like that. This is because Marshawn Lynch has unretired now, and there is some suspicion that he might go to Oakland, which is his hometown, play for the Raiders. And Richard Sherman is just being openly shopped to other teams. At this point, we're willing to trade him for a Groupon that still has 2 weeks on it for karate lessons. I mean, the Seahawks and Richard Sherman seem to have really fallen out of love. The reason I think this is interesting above and beyond just sports is because Richard Sherman is iconic in this city at this point. I mean, he's people love him. They love his intellect, his brashness. I mean, he really stands for something on this team. And it seems like the Seahawks are saying, and we're fine with him leaving. And what I'm surprised by is I don't think the fans are that upset anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, look, Richard Sherman, I find him endlessly entertaining. He's a great player. You know, he's had a reduction in the number of interceptions and all of that. But, you know, he was a distraction a little bit last year, or maybe a lot. We could debate that. You know, he was getting in coaches' faces, being rude to reporters, which is basically against
the law. I take personally.
That's against the law, as we all know. And so he's a bit of a distraction. He's also 29 years old. And so you could see this happening and people not flipping out like they might have a year or two earlier.
Hmm. Yeah, this is the difference between football and baseball. I mean, your football shelf life is just very short. It's hard to – you can't invest too heavily in a football player because he's gone. And, you know, it's so different than the Ken Griffey days. And
yeah. The cliff that one goes off in terms of their effectiveness as a football player is much steeper than any of the other sports. And I mean, you got to say, the general manager of the Seahawks, John Schneider, is clearly a bright individual. He and Pete Carroll have managed to bring together quite a group of guys. And so he knows what's up. And if they were to let Richard Sherman go or to trade him, I would think it would probably be partially because of kind of communication issues and partially because they might know something we don't know, which is that Richard Sherman may have one or two more really elite seasons in him. And then we'll start a bit of a decline. Speaking of things that have been somewhat in decline, a new proposal, in fact, two proposals came in this week for Key Arena. We don't have a ton of time left, but what I thought was interesting is one of the groups that wants to spend over $500 million to fix it says they don't even need to put a pro sports team in because they have Pearl Jam, who is going to take up residency in Key Arena and just play like 100 concerts a year or something.
But that tells you quite a lot about what's going on in that business, because you have to have maybe the three prongs, the two teams and concerts, to make it work. Because of the financing of it.
Yeah. We'll see what happens with that. We have got to get out of here. But first of all, thank you so much to our panel, Joni Balter, Dave Ross, Phyllis Fletcher. Thank you to everybody who came out to the KUOW performance space. We want to thank the staff at KUOW who made this thing happen. Lisa Wang, Holly Seiler, engineers Tim Mining and Rob Springer, Bond Huberman over on the Twitters, and Jason Pagano, our producer, plus KUOW general manager Karen Mathis. My name is Luke Burbank. If you just can't get enough of me, I'll be at the Neptune Theater tomorrow night with Dan Savage and Bob Ferguson doing my Livewire radio show. So maybe we'll see you there. Thanks a lot. Have a great day, everybody.